Hello everybody, it's George from Ireland, so welcome back to my channel. And yes, I have showered for change. But anyway, this is about Ukraine joining NATO, because the leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, he controversially a few days ago said that really it was this talk of Ukraine being admitted to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that precipitated the war. But you've got to be fair to Mr. Farage. He did say that Russia is at fault. It was Putin's decision. They started the war. Now, they're very seldom conflicts where one side is 100% good and the other 100% evil. And I have heard it from the mainstream Russian perspective. I mean, unlike most people in the United Kingdom, I've watched Pervom, Rossiya, and various Russian TV channels, watched their news broadcasts, read some of their newspapers. And even today on Instagram, following Kremlin Towers, Putin, and his various Putin mouthpieces. So I do comprehend their worldview, which is not to say I sympathize with it. I mean that in the literal sense of I know what they believe, and I can perceive their internal logic. Sometimes it's fallacious, sometimes it's based on outrageous falsehoods. So the thing is that the Baltic republics, which are much smaller, joined NATO's nary a peep out of them. Why does Ukraine matter so much more? Partly because, of course, Kyiv is the birthplace of Russia. It was Kievan Rus. The fulcrum of power only moved to Moscow later. And Moscow is only dated from, is it the 12th century AD, when Yuri Dolgoruki, as in Yuri Long Arms, wrote a letter, the very first written mention of Moscow, have dinner with me at my home in Moscow. And they celebrate that the way that's dated someday in September every year. We don't really know when the city was founded, but in their prehistoric artifacts on that Kremlin hill. But anyway, so you know, Russia was almost a failed state in the 90s, where even nuclear weapons troops weren't paid for 6 months, and Russia just could have been bought. And Russia completely imploding would not have been good news for the wider world, because they would have had bioweapons, chemical weapons, nuclear weapons, the only thing they had to sell. You know, Chechnya broke away, these bloody wars in the 90s. Tatarstan declared independence and was threatened to back down on that, so they did. Because Tatarstan had gone, that could have set off a chain reaction, and Russia could have split up into dozens of different countries, a free-for-all, different countries piling in to grab territory. So maybe better thing that it did not completely implode. Although some people say no, seeing when Russia got back on its feet, how horrific that was for its neighbors, maybe even better thing if it had split up. But certainly, although there's all this sudden condemnation of the Western world, it was the United States, it was West Germany, it was France, it was the United Kingdom, and even Oriental countries like Japan. They're the ones who bailed Russia out, who saved them, gave them the loans they desperately needed them. It's very easy to point the finger. Rather than accept it was the Communist Party had ruined things, had oppressed them, had terrorized them, is Yeltsin's incompetence and his kleptocracy, his peculation that led to Russia being in that sorry impasse. I know that the situation began to improve from 97, about 6 years into the post-communist era, began improving. It took several years to reach where they had been in 91, and Putin took over on New Year's Eve 1999, and he inherited an improving situation, though still brittle. Anyway, about 2008, that's when they began to massively rearm. And who was the Cassandra at the time? The one voice crying in the wilderness was Dr. Liam Fox, a Conservative MP. Sometime was he Defence Secretary? Certainly Shadow Defence Secretary. He's no longer in Parliament, I think. But nobody else was talking about this, that there was a massive rearmament. They doubled the defence budget in 1 year. That was ominous. It was the year that Medvedev did that job swap with Putin. He became president for 4 years, whilst Putin went back to being prime minister, because the constitution restricted Putin to two consecutive terms. Then they amended the constitution to allow him another two terms, extend the presidential term from 4 years to six. There was a slight risk, a well-informed Russian who grew up in Crimea told me this, that actually that Medvedev wouldn't vacate the presidency at the end of the 4 years. But in the end, he did actually honour the gentleman's agreement. That Bucharest summit, it was early in 2008, when it was agreed that Ukraine would eventually be admitted to NATO. But of course, NATO had, goodness, how many members was it then? 28. Even one of them could have vetoed Ukraine joining. And Romania had only just joined NATO itself shortly before that. You see NATO flags all over Romania at the time. Romania, remember, having been a communist country, having been occupied by Red Army troops into the 1950s. But pursued a fairly independent foreign policy from 1968 onwards, though being formally a member of the Warsaw Pact, as in that Soviet-led military alliance. But Ukraine matters so much more because it's so much bigger. Because it's how much is it, like over 600,000 square kilometers? So, I mean, besides Russia, is the biggest country in Europe except for France. And there's the Black Sea, because so much of the Black Sea littoral is Ukrainian. And if the Ukrainians control Crimea, everything on the Russian Black Sea coast is within range. Remember, the Russian Black Sea fleet was there. At the dissolution of the Soviet Union, it was agreed that the Russian Black Sea fleet could maintain their ports at Sevastopol and elsewhere for a quarter of a century. Now, in 2008, up until then, Putin thought he could indirectly control Ukraine because a significant minority of Ukrainians were inclined towards Russia, maybe 30% of them. And with a bit of cheating and with forming an alliance with another party, that pro-Russian bloc, mainly the Party of the Regions, could control Ukraine. Remember, the part of the regions, the whole idea for greater regional autonomy was to enfeeble the Ukrainian state and therefore allow Russia to exert greater control over at least the eastern and southern regions of Ukraine, the most Russophone regions of Ukraine. Really the ones that Russia is at least part occupying now, Crimea, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk. To some extent, Kharkiv, which they haven't managed to seize. That's been the second biggest city in Ukraine, only 30 kilometers from the Russian frontier. And I know people, I've met people from those regions, and some of them are Russophone, even Russian, ethnically Russian, but that doesn't automatically mean they want to be part of Russia. So the Baltics, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, they were so small, Russia didn't care about them that much. The other one is they'd not been in the Russian Empire all the time, but really the Russians regarded Ukraine is in a sense even more Russian than Russia is, because all right, then the fulcrum of power shifted to Moscow, and some of those other power cities in the Golden Ring around Moscow, like Vladimir, had been capital briefly. St. Petersburg, the capital from 1704. Remember, they didn't control the St. Petersburg area at all to the end of the 17th century. That was part of Sweden. And most of Russia is not really Russian at all. It's from the 16th century on. Ivan the Terrible, Ivan Grozny, means more like fearsome, maybe better translation. He conquered Kazan from the Tatars, went, you know, east of the Volga, east of the Urals, and into the south into the Caucasus. So that's not real Russia. True Russia is to the west of the Volga, maybe to the south of the Gulf of Finland, to the north of the Black Sea, and so on. But whereas historically Ukraine was Russian for a very long time, but all right, new nations emerge. They're conquered by Poland in the late Middle Ages. They're somewhat Polonized. Didn't mean the Poles and the Ukrainians always got on, even though, you know, there's some commonalities between them. It's a bit like, you know, Ireland and England. You know, we in Ireland, virtually all of us have at least a little bit of English blood. We're very culturally anglicized. And likewise, the English are sort of partly Irish and culturally hibernicized to some extent. But that doesn't stop ultra-nationalist headbangers denying the plain truth. So Ukraine joining, that would be the second most populous country in the former Soviet Union. That'd be a big headache for Russia, and so on. So up to this point, Putin thought he could indirectly control Ukraine by having a marionette there. Narrowly failed in the 2004 presidential election because the Orange Revolution, because of mass demonstrations, thought he could succeed when he had a second bite of the cherry, which he eventually did in 2012, getting Viktor Yanukovych, his liege man of life and limb, elected. So far going to plan. But then he's forced out by those mass demonstrations at the time of the Euromaidan, despite Berkut, the police, shooting dead over 100 unarmed protesters in Kyiv. And the other thing is the Black Sea Fleet arrangement. NATO says, Ukraine, if you're to join NATO, you cannot have the Russian Black Sea Fleet there in Crimea. They could be spying on us. They're a NATO territory. No. So that 25-year agreement was due to expire in 2016. And Yanukovych, the last thing he did before he hightailed out to Moscow was to sign another 25-year lease for Russia to keep those naval bases. So Ukraine had bent over backwards to be accommodating to the Russians, allow them to keep those Black Sea naval bases, had made Russian a co-official language. It was the principal language of Crimea and some other eastern regions and so on. And relations actually very amicable in the 90s. It's really only when Putin came along that was a problem. So Putin began to see that he wasn't going to be able to control it indirectly. He was going to have to use force. And that'd be such a much bigger frontier with NATO troops there. And then, you know, NATO troops in Ukraine could mean a NATO thrust could easily get through to the Volga and cut southern Russia off from the major part of Russia and so on. It would deny the Black Sea to so much of the to the Russian fleet and so forth. So that's why they felt imperiled by that. But there's also this unacceptance of freedom, both at home and abroad, unacceptance of Ukrainian independence, unacceptance of Ukrainian nationhood, denial of what's happened, nostalgia for the Soviet or Russian imperial epoch, and so on, and wish to deny people their rights. And of course, if democracy succeeds in Ukraine, if they have human rights in Ukraine, if they have free and fair elections, if they have an independent judiciary and so forth, if they have the right to protest, and if it prospers, why shouldn't Russia have the same? They might start demanding the same. You've seen this in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, countries with like no oil, no gas, no coal, hardly any metals, any minerals, not much farmland, tiny countries, nobody else speaks their language, and they're far more prosperous than Russia just through good governance and freedom and anti-corruption. And that's obviously a dangerous precedent for the Putin regime when their people say that. So Putin obviously did not want to allow freedom to succeed. Anyway, so that's why he regards NATO as being such bad news. And if NATO succeeds there, looks like Armenia is wanting to leave the Collective Security Treaty Organization. That's Russia's pathetically tiny answer to NATO. Other Central Asian countries, and really that's the end of Russia. And, you know, other regions might want to break away and become independent. So that's my answer. That's why Putin considers NATO to be such an existential threat to his regime. Thank you so much for watching my channel. Make sure you subscribe on Patreon, donate on PayPal, georgecallahan79@gmail.com. Bye.